Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's a beautiful day. I'm so grateful and thankful for so many things, and I am just very, very excited about tonight's broadcast. As you know, we've been doing a series with Brother Orwahehi Metara and Comet, a phenomenal series. We've been looking at the Asante model and different aspects of that model, and tonight actually concludes the series, and I'm just very, very excited and grateful and humbled that Brother Orwa has taken time out of his schedule to share this information with us. And so, again, I just want to thank all of the listeners that have tuned in, for everybody that has shared the links. This is very phenomenal information, and I just think that with your help in sharing this information, we can get this information out to a lot of people, and they can actually tune in, learn, grow, and evolve. So I thank you so much, everybody, for sharing the links. Welcome to all of the new listeners to Health, Wealth, and Divine. We see the numbers growing. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let me tell you a little bit about my special guest, in case you are tuning in for the very first time. Orwahehi Metara in Comet has been a member of the Osara Set Society since 1975. He was appointed Orwa, which is Paramount King of the D.C. region of the Osara Set Society, by Shechem Meshechem, Ra Un Nefer Amen, who is the chief priest and king of the Osara Set Society. As Orwa, he is responsible for guiding the lives of Osara Set's members and the society's activities in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's a member of the society's Kerry Hebb priesthood and headed Osara Set's African Support Project. He also holds a bachelor's degree in African American Studies and a master's degree in education, both from Howard University. And as I stated, he's been my special guest for the last several months as we've been doing this series. He's also written a book. It's called African Names, The Ancient Egyptian Keys to Unlocking Your Power and Destiny. And also, we've done a series on the 11 Laws of God, which you can find in the archives. So if you just go back in the archives and scroll down, you will see all of the shows that we've done with Brother Orwahehi Metara in Comet. I encourage you to listen to each and every one of them. They're filled with knowledge and wisdom, and you'll be so glad that you did. Okay, now let me get to my special guest for the day. Brother Orwa, welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's always a pleasure and an honor. I say a netarak to you, my brother. It's always a very special occasion when I have an opportunity to speak with you and you come on and share this wisdom. I know that you're a very busy person, and just the fact that you've agreed to come on and share this information is a blessing. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having given this opportunity.
You're so very, very welcome, my brother. Well, as I've stated to the listeners, we've been doing a series on the Asante model, and we've covered different aspects of the Asante. We've did the overview. We've looked at political and spiritual. We've looked at social. We've looked at economics. We've looked at the environmental and administrative principles. And tonight, we're going to be talking about, well, after having looked at all of that, now, where do we go from here? So, again, brother, thank you so much. If you'd like to briefly take us, the listeners, through just a brief recap of what brought us to where we are now, to the point where we are at the crossroads, asking the question, very important question that begs the answer, where do we go from here?
Well, as we said earlier, we began this project as a PhD thesis at the University of Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Ghana back in 2008, and then we began working on the research in 2009, actually. And we finally concluded with the submission of the paper this past summer, 2015. And so what we've been doing is looking at the premise of the thesis, the background of the thesis, the premise of the thesis, the results, things that will be discovered through the work of the process, And then tonight we're going to look at, you know, where do we go from here would be the conclusions and recommendations. As a part of the process, when you submit a thesis document, dissertation, then the review of the literature and how you went about gathering the data and your findings and that kind of stuff. There's also present recommendations on things that you think could be improved as a result of what you've done. And so we were looking at the divine kingship of Asante as a model for sustainable development of self and community. And so we're looking at it from the perspective of the research question had to do with whether or not it was a political model, a good social model, a good economic model, a good environmental model. And then could the values or the principles, the administrative principles, that the kingship promotes be useful to others, people outside of the Asante. Meaning could people in other parts of Ghana, maybe the Western political systems or even other political systems, look at this as something of value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we looked at the kingship system through three periods. We looked at it through the pre-colonial period, or the inception period, which began around 1700 or so with the establishment of the kingship. And the kingship began as a result of the Asante people coming together and deciding that they were going to individually give up some of their independence, some of their sovereignty, so that they could unify around one of their numbers. So one member of the group became the first among, what's called the first among equals. And everyone agreed that this would be the focal point of the nation, so they bound the king together. And the good analogy of this, so it's better to use an analogy, let's just clarify what exactly took place. Meaning
okay.
that at that point, the Asante people were, they were operating in several different paramounts, meaning they were kings in their own right. So there was about seven or so different areas, but each of them had complete autonomy over their own area. But they were also being subjugated by a rival kingdom that was in their locality called Denshera. So every year they had to come up with payment to the king of Denshera in terms of slaves and, you know, foodstuffs and gold or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came together one night, led by a traditional priest named Okonfo Noche. They came together to discuss what was going on with them and how could they address the situation. And so this priest, according to the story, calls a golden stool to come from the heavens. And this golden stool descended from the heavens. They said that whoever's lap it lighted upon, whoever's lap it landed on, would now become the first among equals, meaning become the king of everybody else. Everyone would pledge their allegiance. All these individual kings would pledge their allegiance to this one man who would become the king of all of them. And so they gave up something to get something. And so it lighted on the lap of Osei Tutu the first. And he then became the first Asante Henny. So this took place around 1699, 1700 or so. And by doing so, though, by coming together, by unifying, by giving up, by sacrificing some of what they individually may have had or may have wanted, they were able to empower themselves collectively and to defeat the Denshera king. And then began the establishment of the Asante Confederacy. So there's a great lesson there in terms of what true unity is about. I mean, we're in a situation here as African people in the U.S. and the world over but we'll just use our system, our status as a primary focus. And that, you know, there's always a great big chant that takes place in the black community here that, you know, we can't unify. We don't unify. You know, there's no unity in the black community. You know, we've heard all the slogans and all the sayings that have been preached and marched and all the other things that's taking place. But then we don't really truly grasp what true unity is. And so the Asante model gives us a classic historical reference in terms of what it takes to become unified as a group. Meaning each of us, see, we've been raised here in the West, and the mantra of the West is the so-called rugged individual, do for self, etc. And that mantra is useful for the people who promote it, because as long as people are looking out for their own personal interests, they won't come together to seize on the opportunity to rectify their collective interests, because they will always be looking at one another with out of the corner of their eye, believing that someone else is going to get take advantage of them, themselves, or get one up on them, the old crab in the barrel kind of, of philosophy. And so if I wanted to keep people, you know, it's very easy for one person to dominate 100 people if I can convince those 100 people that they're actually just one person. So as long as I got people thinking individually about their own personal goals and aspirations and characteristics and problems, et cetera, and prevent them from seeing themselves as a collective, then I can control them. And that's what the condition that the Asante were in, but they were able to overcome that condition because they accepted the understanding that in order to become better at who we are, we have to each individually give up something to the collective. So that's the first big lesson that we can glean from this. If we're going to solve the problems, come together, you know, there's always the talk about I don't know how much of this stays. I mean, $1 trillion, whatever, that flows through the hands of black people. Why are we all so poor? Well, that's just the key. It's flowing through our hands as opposed to flowing to us. And we're not unified enough to understand that if we were to give up our own personal interests, meaning if we were all collectively understand that by putting this into a first amongst equals, if we promoted someone or something to become the focal point of our effort, then we then can come together and empower ourselves to overcome whatever the problem is that we're facing. Because there's got to be something that's a spiritual base, which is the other critical piece, that they just didn't, there's an act of God that brought these people together, meaning that there's a spiritual source, resurrection that took place within their psyche. You know, the descent of this golden stool from the heavens, this act of bringing this item from the heavens to give to the people was as a source of the divinity within them, was critical to the unification of the people. So we have to then understand that if we're going to come together, then we have to also come together with a different self-image, which is what we've been talking about. So we have to see that we can never come together as human beings, because as human beings, by nature, we're going to be divided, because that's the nature of the human psyche.
Yes.
But if we accept the fact that we're not human beings but divine beings, which by nature means that we are unified, we're one, then we can begin to use that new focus, that understanding of unification of focus as a vehicle to come together and to address our common issue, the common things that we each of us are dealing with during the course of our lives. So this is what the Asante were able to do in 1700 or thereabouts, which led to the Asante, establishment of the Asante Confederacy. So it went from there, 1700 to around 1896, finally, when it was militarily defeated by the British. Now, there have been two or three significant wars during that period, around 1824 or so, to 1874 or so, which led to the final military defeat. Well, not military defeat, but in 1896 when the British captured the king of Asante and exiled him to the Seychelles Islands, he and some of his other people. But the final war, military war, was waged by the queen mother, one of the queen mothers of Asante, Yasantuan I, around 1900, against the British, because the British had governor had told the Asante that they had to give him the golden stool. Now, the same golden stool that we were talking about earlier, which was, came from God, was like represented the soul of the nation. That's what it was. That comfort notion, when we brought it down, he said, whoever lands on will become the king of all of us, and it becomes the soul of the nation. So it's like the heart of the Asante. So, for the British governor to request that the Asante get up and go on the stool would be like me coming to you and say, give me your heart or I'm going to kill you. Well, if you give me your heart, you're dead anyway. Right?
Right.
That's not a proposition. There's no choice but to go to war here, the battle. So, they ended up going to war. The British were able to militarily subdue the Asante, but they never captured the golden stool, which was the object of the war. So, technically speaking, the Asante, the British didn't win the war. They militarily subdued the Asante, but they never won the war.
Okay.
They never got the golden stool. So, anyway, so there's a lot of growth and challenge that the Asante Nation went through from its inception in 1700. To 1896, 1900, when it was finally subdued by the British and made a part of the Gold Coast Colony. But during that period, as the empire was growing, the Asante Empire at its peak was larger than the current state of Ghana itself. So it had grown significantly. But it wasn't just a constant war of conquest. There was a principle, a fundamental principle of the Asante was decentralization of the empire, meaning that just as these seven initial Paramount kings came together and gave up some sovereignty so that one could be elevated to them, they all continued to reign and operate within their own areas, basically independent. The central government, the Asante Henny, could not interfere in the affairs of there unless it became a part of a dispute that raised itself to his level. So any and all the administrative functions and activities within the paramountcies were still ran by the paramountcies, by the kings and queens of those areas.
Okay.
Now, as Asante was expanding, and it first defeated Dentura, right? That was those were the people that were subjugating it. So then Dentura became a part of the Asante kingdom.
Okay.
But every group that the Asante conquered in terms of their expansion, the kings, if they were not killed in battle, were allowed to continue to rule their area as sovereign. There was an Asante governor or such present, but the king still, they didn't totally take their power. So they maintained, each individual maintained their own sovereignty as it became a part of the Confederacy. So the critical word is the Confederacy. So which then enabled people to benefit, even though they were defeated militarily by the Asante, they still were able to benefit from the inclusion into the Asante Empire as it grew. So when the British eventually defeated it, the empire was quote unquote destroyed. The vassal states were given their independence. The king was taken out, so that means the kingdom was kingless for a period of almost 40 years. And the British could then process of what's called indirect rule, where they would put in puppets into different positions. The king of Kumasi, there was no king of the king of the Asante Henny, who was the king of all the Asante, was his position was reduced to the king of Kumasi. When he was returned, he was exiled in 1896. He returned to Ghana in something like 1926 or something like that. And then, but he wasn't given his position as the king of the Asante. He was just given himself as the king of Kumasi.
Asante Henny, that's his title?
That's a title. Asante Henny means king of the Asante, all the Asante.
Okay.
So he was returned to Ghana along with the people that had been exiled, and the remains of others that were brought back as well. So the story, some people say Yasanta came back with him. Some people say that she died in Seychelles and her remains were brought back by him. But all of those that had been rulers, for the most part, had come back, those who wanted to come back. Some of them had gotten involved with the people in the Seychelles, so they stayed in the Seychelles Islands. So there's a significant Asante community in the Seychelles Island today of descendants of those who were exiled back in 1896. As a matter of fact, the current king, Otumfo II, just concluded a trip to Seychelles a few months back where they went down and they were they met with the descendants of those who had not been repatriated, who didn't come back, who stayed in the Seychelles Islands.
Okay.
So the British took over the administration. They started a process called indirect rule, where they would then they would remove people from positions who were not cooperative with the British intent and put in their own puppets. And so this largely became the model for the throughout the colonial period, which led to a lot of problems within the kingdom itself. Now, in 1935, the new king, Prempeh I, had passed. His successor, Prempeh II, came into the stool around 1931 or so. But he came to the stool again as the king of Kumasi, not the Asante Henny, because the British had abolished the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1935, the British restored the Asante Confederacy, and Prempeh II became the Asante Henny again. Now, there are those who say that the reason why the British did it is because he became a willing participant in the British agenda in terms of doing the things that they wanted to do. And then there are those who say, well, he may have done so, but his goal was to reestablish the kingdom so that, you know, they could begin to build and move forward. In either case, it's obvious that he did, in fact, he was favored by the British. He did work with them, and the kingdom was restored. But there were challenges. The indirect rule became another challenge, or a continuing challenge, during his reign up until independence, when Ghana became independent in 1957, which began the third period of of discussion. So from 1957 to 2014 was the time period that we were looking at in terms of the post-colonial period or the independent era, as it's referred to.
Okay.
And during this period, we were confident, we were looking at the changes that were going on within the kingdom. And with each of these epochs, so to speak, there was a diminishment of the power and the authority of the traditional rulers in each different era. And each era got weaker and weaker. So, but still, within the independence era, there was another challenge. There's a big challenge between the Asante and Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Because they Nkrumah wanted to, his goal was to unify everyone in Ghana and kind of be less of an independent scenario for each of the groups. But the Asante and other groups wanted to maintain their culture and their identity. As a matter of fact, the Asante petitioned the British, at the point that the British were about to grant independence, they established their own political party called the National Liberation Movement, which became an opposition party to Nkrumah's CPP. And they began to petition and agitate for Ghana, for Asante to be given separate independence from the rest of Ghana.
Okay.
The British denied their request and included them, kept them as part of the independent state. But that didn't resolve or eliminate the challenge between the political strife that was taking place between the NLM and the CPP government.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as a part of that course, Ghana had gone through several periods of development of change and independence, and the final one is just the current situation. There's a constitution which was adopted, wherein there's a parallel system in Ghana where you have the traditional rulers who are given their own administrative function through what's called the National House of Chiefs, and then you have the political system, the political parties that run the National House, Parliament, etc. And along the way, even though the traditional rulers still maintain some autonomy within their areas and some authority within their areas, there has been a gradual diminishment of their authority and power. And the greater the closer they are to the political centers, the less power they afford or will. The more remote they are, then the more autonomy they have, or the more authority they're able to wield within their areas.
You mean in terms of their actual physicality when you say remote, as opposed to
in the major centers like Accra, like Kumasi, like the larger metropolitan centers, the political system of representatives and they have a parliament and those members of the parliament, etc., have more authority and influence and direct input into what takes place. But then in villages, the further villages from those political centers, the more autonomy or more authority the chiefs have. Because, again, within the village system, the chiefs are looked upon, for the most part, as the true authorities in there, so that the people out there, any administrators out there, members of parliament or whatever, work in conjunction, and this takes place even in some of the larger metropolitan areas where they still consult and work, try to work with on some levels for the most part, the traditional rulers. But in terms
what
of,
role would you say education plays in that? What role would you say that education plays in that dynamic? Because I guess I would assume that the further, you know, you go into, say, you know, the remote villages or whatever, maybe the less, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the less educated they may be. And as you go into the major cities where there's more education, quote, end quote, and possibly even more people having been educated and with the Western influence, then, you know, that might play a role in the, you know, the dynamic that you mentioned, how the further remote you go, then the more, you know, I guess, powerful the traditional chiefs or leaders would be. Is that, do you think education has any role to play in that, in the Western influence?
Well, there's two pieces. Western education and Western influence, religion, Christianity and Islam, not a Western religion, but foreign, these foreign ideologies and Western education have a great impact on the diminishment of the traditional systems in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the, because, unfortunately, especially with through the religious piece, you know, traditional religion is looked upon as primarily superstitious or witchcraft or whatever to a large degree these days. And a lot of the traditional, as we discussed the last few weeks, the traditional system, inside the traditional religion, is embedded as the foundation of the traditional systems. As we said, the beginning of the kingdom was through the spiritual work of the traditional priest, Akonfenochi, who called the golden stool. One of the many miracles that Akonfenochi did, by the way, was to bring the golden stool down from the heavens. There are some 77 or more miracles that are documented that this man performed. But it's rooted in the traditional spiritual, Santi traditional religion. But, you know, whereas around the 1800s or so, 100% of the people who were a part of the Asante area, traditional area, were practicing the Asante traditional religion. Today, according to the latest census, 2010, less than 1% of the people classify themselves as practitioners of the Asante traditional religion. Now, that doesn't mean that those who classify themselves as Christian or Muslim don't participate in some of the Asante traditional practices. It's not uncommon for people to go to the shrines on the spiritual days and then go to church on Sunday. That's not an uncommon practice. But it's largely because of the growth and expanse of the proselytization of the evangelist movement in Ghana, and the evangelists coming over from the U.S. and other places, a large number of people, especially the youth, a lot of the youth are adopting and accepting the Western, the Christian, quote-unquote, idea that traditional practitioners are practicing witchcraft or, you know, evil or whatever, and that, which is creating a lot of problems within the community, because as the traditional systems begin to break down, then that means that the moral fabric and character basis of the communities also begin to break down. And this will be discussed in terms of the cultural underpinnings, the moral underpinnings of the administrative philosophical principles, right? And in terms of, we did surveys as a part of the study, and, you know, the surveys are not going to be 100% accurate because we didn't survey all 4 million people who live in the Asante traditional area.
Right.
So we had a sampling of about 300 people that we surveyed. But out of those 300 people, The numbers ran something like those who believe that the political, the Santi political principles could serve as the foundation for sustainable development of self and community were around 60%. Those that believe that the social principles of the Asante traditional vision of the 70%, meaning that they believe that the social values that are traditional within the Asante structure, 70% of them believe it was is promoting of sustainable development within self and community around 70%. Those who believe that it was environmentally or environmentally and economically sustainable were both around 50%. So, you know, it wasn't a large number of people who were in agreement that, you know, it was still the majority, but it was still a very close, you know, around every one out of every two people believed that. But in terms of whether or not the administrative principles of the Asante leadership, those things that are taught, those things that are used to cultivate and nurture the kings and the queen mothers, those who are put in positions of power, could serve as a vehicle to promote and sustain the sustainable development of Asante, and that these principles could be beneficial if they were practiced by people outside of Asante. It was like 89% of the same group of people saw that these principles and values would be a great benefit. And they're looking at it from the perspective of what they see within the Western model. Because today, this is an election year in Ghana. And as it is an election year here.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of viral discussion and attitude that you see here in terms of these politicians, you see the same thing kind of reflected in Ghana amongst the mm-hmm. different political parties. And mm-hmm. you also find that in Africa, and these political issues and disturbances can lead to actual bloodshed in terms of these different disagreements. So people see that how the result of this Western model, the practice of the Western model, and how some people become so polarized in it that they see that, well, when there's the appointment of a chief or a queen mother, there may be some people vying, different people vying for a position, but it never, rarely does it raise itself to the level of someone physically getting harmed or killed as a result of this competition. That the competition is not based on popularity or economics or whatever. It's based on character development, character and moral qualities and characteristics. You know, they're looking at the content of the person's character, so to speak, versus, you know, whatever else they have. So they're saying that, you know, if we could import this, take these same principles that these men and women are being cultivated through in order to assume leadership in their traditions as traditional rulers, if those same principles and values were being exposed, I'm not going to say exposed to, but most of the political people come through the same kinds of social mores that the kings and queen mothers are exposed to. There might be some more specialized training that people in the royals get, but by and large, within most societies within Ghana, you get the same kind of importance being laid, or at least preached and talked about in terms of morality and, you know, good character and all those things. But if so, the people are saying if these kinds of character values could be promoted and instituted and carried forth by the political leaders, it would be a much better society than it is today. So that's kind of an overview, a summary of what we were able to discuss and discover through the course of this study.
Well, what role would, we didn't really touch upon it in the previous discourses, the role of holidays, what role did that play, or does that play today in the Asante? Because I know you mentioned, you spoke about Durbas, and I don't know if Durbas are just surrounding, you know, the big celebration, if that's just surrounding the appointment of a queen mother or a chief, or is there, are there, you know, certain holidays that are unique to the Asante? I know you mentioned that Inyame is, you know, the name that they use for God, and, you know, that's a whole system within itself. Do they have holidays that would help to promote the spiritual systems, the spiritual, I guess, systems, for lack of a better term, that would help to reinforce the spiritual side of the principles that we know, as you mentioned, underlie most, if not all, African, traditional African religions?
Well, the answer is yes. They have two, three primary, referred to them as holy days. You know, holiday became the secularization of the concept of holy days.
Okay.
Within the Asante tradition, what we call holidays is when you just took God out of the event and put money as the focus.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally, these things were all called holy days, and so the Asante have two primary ones that they operate now: a Kwesi day and a Wuku day, which take place every 40th. Sunday, every, not 40th, Sunday, 40 days and then Sunday and then 40 days and then Wednesday. And
mm-hmm.
both of these days are rooted in, and as are the other 2 days, they're all rooted within the Asante traditional religion. So they're days of spiritual ritual and sacrifice and those kinds of things that the kings and the queen mothers participate in. And then there's a communal and a community experience or offering. So those, and that becomes the basis of preserving and transmission of the culture.
Okay.
But unfortunately, as we were talking about, a number of leaders and on different levels are practicing, quote-unquote, foreign religions. Some of them don't even participate in these celebrations, which is a weakening, undermining of the culture itself.
Mm-hmm.
So
I can see that.
Yeah, so that's where we are today. Now, in terms of the in the course of this work, there were several recommendations, if you will, that were put forth. That should be considered, from my perspective, things that should be considered to improve and strengthen the divine kingship. Right? In terms of the political situation, we made several recommendations. One was that the traditional priests should be formed into what we refer to as an academy. During the course of the discussion, we made several references to scientific discoveries, quote unquote, that support the practice the traditional practices, so-called, what people refer to, many people refer to as superstitious practices of the spiritual, of African spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we, one, I mean, there's a bunch of classic ones there's the concept of communication with plants in order to gain insight from the plants in terms of helping mankind. And we all know the story, well, we should all know the story over here of George Washington Carver. I think we made reference to that before. That George Washington Carver was, you know, the man who saved the Southern economy, literally, of the United States with his crop rotation and bringing in planting peanuts and other sweet potatoes and other crops. And he actually, some people credit him with winning the war with his extracts from different plants in terms of foodstuffs and dyes and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And the man was scientifically trained. He had a BA in biochemistry or something of that nature. But he was taught by people with PhDs, and there were a lot of PhDs, and none of them could come up. None of them came up with the extracts and solutions that Dr. Carver came up with. So the question becomes, well, where did he get his information from? And when anyone asked him how he was able to find out how to do all these things with the peanut or the sweet potato or all these, he was the first person to begin to develop plastics out of plants. You know, the whole bio industry that is developing today, well, Carver was working on that back in the 1930s and 40s. He had a contract with Henry Ford and was working on developing tires, not out of rubber, but out of plant extracts. And he was successful in that process. So the question was, how did he come up with all this stuff? And he was straightforward. He told anybody who would ask him, anyone who would listen, that he communicated with the plants. He would go out into the woods every morning, and he would just ask them plants, you know, who has something for me today, basically. And different plants would talk to him and say, you can use me to do this, that, and the other. Now, people discounted this, right? But the proof is in the pudding. The man was able to do stuff that people with far greater training, scientific training, Western training, were not able to do. And he himself communicated. He said this is how he did it. And he wasn't trying to hide anything, not for an economic advantage, because a man, he could have patented over 1,000 different things. He had like 3 patents. The man could have been a millionaire, literally, back in those days. But he wasn't in it for the economy. He stayed at Tuskegee. He kept the same salary he was making at Tuskegee, and he just gave this stuff away.
Wow.
So that's the spiritual force that was moving. And he said he talked to the spirits, and the spirits would tell him what each plant was good for, the spirit in the plant. A practice that has long been looked at with, you know, questionable eyes in terms of African spirituality. You know, it's not uncommon to when you speak to a traditional practitioner, and then the classic example is the man who, the artisan, who was going to make a drum or a statue or whatever, before he would cut down a tree, would go and communicate with the spirit of the tree in order to get permission to take the limb and talk about, you know, what the benefit it would have to the community, et cetera. Well, you know, this has been looked upon as superstitious, you know, for a lot of people. But now they're doing plant research with plants and discovering that people are able to communicate with plants. Plants are able to communicate with one another. And that interlocking relationship that plants and different animal species have where they communicate with one another. The plants are even able, you know, like there's a tree in Ghana, amongst the Asante, that they say you have to be a very skillful, trained person to cut down this tree, or it may cause you harm, right? So the idea was, it's superstitious, people just want to buy and cut the tree. But, you know, they've discovered that there are plants that when they're being overgrazed by animals, that the plants change the chemical content of their leaves such that the animals get sick when they eat too much of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so there's a lot of research that people are doing around plants and with plants that can be needs to be expanded on, needs to be promoted, needs to be cultivated, and promoted within Asante,
mm-hmm.
African traditional circles in general, but with Asante in particular. So one of the recommendations is that they establish this academy to take and begin to codify the practices of these traditional priests and priestesses.
Mm-hmm.
That will give a lot of credence to the system itself, which will then begin to change in the eyes of the people the idea that these are just charlatans or superstitious people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the recommendations, that an academy be established to do this work of codifying the practices, scientifically verifying the practices that are taking place.
Mm-hmm. That's a good recommendation. Mm-hmm.
There was another recommendation that the academy be developed in order to still again to promote the spiritual, the importance of the Santi's traditional religion. I think we mentioned a few discussions back about the practice of Inyame Su,
mm-hmm.
which was the character of God. It's a practice that the Asante used to do years ago at an Inyame Duo, which is the tree of God's tree, where they would collect rainwater from the heavens and then inscribe it in their forehead and visualize and meditate on how they could become one with God. Daily, this was done. And they also had this process called the soul washing, which was done on the natal day of a person's birth. So if a person was born on a Tuesday, then every Tuesday they would do this thing called soul washing. Again, the purpose of which is to purify one's spirit, to become a perfect reflection of God, which is what Inyame Su represented.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to do that, the foundation of that, though, that Inyame Su practice of inscribing the circle in the forehead, we discussed about the importance of the forehead as the center of spiritual and moral development and cultivation within man through what's called the prefrontal cortex, and that how science has shown and proven that meditation improves and expands the function and the size of the brain, but focusing on the prefrontal cortex also expands one's ability to function as a moral person in the world. And so the idea that I can become one with God, meaning a reflection of the divinity of this perfect God through my character, is wrapped up in this practice of Inyame Su, and the understanding that what modern science has brought to the table of the focus of meditation as empowering the part of the brain which enables me to function in that manner. And we also link that then to what our ancestors in ancient Kemet produced and promoted through the concept of Kente, which was the same thing. So, you know, we made several linkages along the way to ancient Kemet because there's scholarship which suggests that the people of Asante were descendants of ancient Kemet, that they came from ancient Kemet. There's a lot of elements, with cultural elements and spiritual elements within their system that link up very nicely with ancient Kemet. And part of their folklore is also the understanding that they came from that part of the world. So, well, another thing for the Academy to do would then be to take this knowledge about how meditation is in the brain and the connection between the brain and meditation and empowering the ability to become a moral character or to reflect the God of nature within one's person, and codify it and use the model that Ron F. Amen put forth in his Medina Terra series in terms of imploring how to impact and awaken and cultivate these 11 laws within the spirit. So we looked at the first two laws, Amen and Osir, and how they connect very neatly with Inyami, which is the supreme being, the term for the supreme being in the Khan tradition, and in Yom Kippur, which is the one great God, which will link us to Osir. And there's so the other work that we actually can to do is to go through the 11, rest of the 11 laws and make these correspondences. Now, the first four actually are easy, kind of easy to do. But that's a part of what, and what this will do, though, is again add more value and credibility to the Asante traditional religion, because it now becomes a understanding that this is a scientific basis for these practices that were looked upon as just being superstitious by those missionaries that came in and got people to switch over to the Western religious system.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what would be really, very interesting to me is, even as we're having this discussion, just how with the recommendation, even with the 11 laws being, you know, offered as a model, for lack of a better term, how then even the role of justice or the law of Hurukahuti would be would manifest in the people's administering quote justice end quote, because if the thought was or the understanding was that we are divine by nature, and that if somebody is practicing or committing crimes against society or whatever, that it's not that they're evil necessarily by nature or sinners by nature, but that they are just uncultivated or need to be cultivated, then the whole therapy would be a sincere therapeutic resolution to just actually then just throwing somebody in jail. You know, you would actually be trying to, I guess, resurrect the God in that individual, and whatever the remedy would be, it would be towards bringing that person back into alignment with their divinity, as opposed to, you know, casting them off as evil and, you know, throwing away the key.
Yes, very good. So, yeah, I mean, we went through and came up with a number of recommendations for each of these five areas: political, social, economic, environmental, and administrative principles. But I just want to, because we're running out of time, I can see, I just want to highlight how another recommendation that we made, because I don't think we discussed this during the course of this 5 or 6 weeks we've been having this discussion. And this was about the Songhai Center in Benin. Have we talked about this place at all?
Briefly, but
okay.
it deserves more attention if you would like to speak more on it.
Okay. Kosongai is a project that's in Benin. It's named after the ancient West African kingdom of Songhai, but that's just the name. The man who founded it is a Nigerian by birth, but he started the process in Benin. He's a Catholic priest, actually. But he's also a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided to go home in 1985 or so to start something to deal with his ministerial work in terms of trying to help the poor. So he went home in 85 and he got this land from the government and he started this project in 1985. So that's 30 years ago. When he started, he had lost all of his whole shipment of equipment, got lost. The container didn't make it to Benin. He had no money. He just got a few rakes. He found some high school dropouts, and the government gave him an acre of land. And today, Songhai has I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of hectares of land in cultivation in Benin, with the support of the government.
Mm.
But why is Songhai so important and valuable? Well, in terms of, we're talking about sustainable development, and the whole focus of this thesis was looking at the Asante kingship as sustainable institution or institution to sustain the community. Well, in terms of environmental sustainability and economic sustainability, we have to look at, well, what are some things that we can do which will not undermine the development of, will not undermine development, and let's clarify, the economic development. So there's different schools of economic thought in terms of development. But there's a group of ecological, eco-economists, if you will, who define development as not as the constant march of 3% growth in GDP or whatever, but the development of people. That true economic development has to do with the development of people. And that you can't have a sustainable economy based on finite resources. Meaning that if we're going to believe that we have to have an increase of 3% every year, 3 to 5% every year, in terms of using the resources of the earth to generate a 3 to 5% growth. Well, you can't have a sustainable, unlimited growth and with finite resources. The earth is finite. There's only so much land. There's only so many minerals in the land. There's only so many trees. Everything is finite. So if we continue with this model of economic development is the use of the resources and at a growth of 3%, eventually, which is very close to where we are today, we will hit a point where a point of no return, where it can become a diminishing return plan. The whole thing will fall apart. So the key to sustainable development has to do with, I mean, the definition of sustainable development that the UN put forth is a development that meets the needs of the people today without threatening the needs of future generations. So this whole thing that's going on in terms of climate change, et cetera, within the world is a result of a non-sustainable course that these people have put the world in. That the Western model of development is critically threatening the existence of the world. So all the scientists are in agreement, except those that work for Fox News. What does that mean? That means we have to have a model that will enable us to continue to grow and develop people without diminishing or using up or undermining the resource of the earth. So it has to become something where stuff is being used, but it's not being, you know, the concept of recycling. And Songhai is the master of this process in terms of they have a process called ZERI, which is zero emissions, basically a zero waste philosophy, where that one thing becomes an input into another quadrant, another part of the process. So if they grow animals, if they raise animals, animals are going to defecate, animals are going to die, people are going to eat animals, etc. But rather than just burying carcasses and throwing away what's left or whatever, they take that and they use that to generate input into the agricultural and or the aquatic or the fish part of the production. And then they also use a part of it to generate energy through biogas. So the plants that are used, the plants become inputs into the biogas production as well as the fish farming and into crop production for humans as well as for animals. So everything is interrelated and interdependent. So nothing is wasted. And so that's the kind of model, that's the process that Songhai has been at work for the past 30 years, and it is a phenomenal. You have to really see it to believe it. They virtually are a completely sustainable community. They make their own machinery. They grow all this food, organically grown. They make most of the machines that they use to harvest the food, to process the food, to plant the food, are machines that they fabricate themselves. They get old auto parts, old cars, whatever, and they take it into their own little foundry, and they fabricate the pieces to assemble the machines that they need to grow the things or process the foods that they grow in their environment. They generate their own energy through the biogas as well as solar, et cetera. They purify the water. Water, impure water is a big problem in the world over. I mean, we know we're all faced with what's going on right now in Flint, Michigan. But that's bad. But people all over the world are suffering, especially in the so-called undeveloped world, part of the world, are suffering from the lack of clean water and the problems that go along with that in terms of minerals, toxins in the water, and illnesses that come out of that water, et cetera. So Songhai process in Songhai is that even though water is used in all these parts of the production, the water is also purified through the natural processes that nature uses to clean water. And when you go to a natural spring, you know, the water has been filtered through the different rocks and minerals, et cetera, that comes out clean. Well, Songhai mimics that whole process through identifying the different bacteria and the minerals, et cetera, that will filter the water and allow it to come out clean, which reduces all the illnesses that come out of the waterborne situations, like malaria and cholera and those kinds of things. So one of the recommendations is that I've been working with the Paramount Kings in Ghana, well, several of the areas, really, but in the Asante, and for the past 15 years, trying to push and promote and get Songhai into Ghana. And so one of the recommendations is that the Asante Henny put the weight of his office into and aiding us in terms of making this movement. Because everyone who's seen Songhai, there's nobody who walks away from Songhai not loving this place. It's truly a wonder of the world. The director he's got all kinds of UN accolades, all people all over the world. He's constantly, right now, I think he's in Thailand. He's a consultant all over the world for people trying to address the problems that they're having with sustainable development. They did a report, the UN Department of Labor did a report on Songhai that was a sterling report. Songhai can show that 3 years, from 3 to 5 years, all the money that's been invested is recouped and now it's a profitable enterprise. They train youth to give them critical skills to go in to stay in their communities, which is a big problem in Africa, where everyone is leaving the villages, going to the cities, thinking that they're going to find their fortune in the cities, and they end up living on the streets, you know, even selling chocolate or whatever. So Songhai gives youth the skills and to find their microloans to stay in their communities, become productive members of their communities through the different aspects and training that they go through. So it's a phenomenal project. And so that's really the one of the main recommendations is that we can get this Santa Henry to take this up and put the weight of his office behind it, because we want to try to move this project forward this year. Because as I said earlier, this is an election year in Ghana too, and in election years, you know time what's going to happen next year. The new government start all over again. Juan, if you can hear me, I cannot hear you. So anyway, we want to thank you again for your opportunity to the platform to discuss this information. We hope that we've said something that can be a benefit to those who've taken the time out of their days to share this time with us, and we look forward to working with everyone so that we can all make real the creed of our ancestors, that we are all divine beings and we've come to Earth to manifest that divinity. Get that book.